It's time to open up a can of advertisements.
I have not been to New Mexico, but I know two things about it for sure. Number one, it is beautiful. Number two, there is a lot of delicious food there. So if you're a true adventurer who loves traveling with your friends or family to totally unique places, you don't want to miss New Mexico for your next destination. There's so much to learn about New Mexico. To do that and plan your trip, visit newmexico.org. New Mexico, true. Pete and Jerry's has done one thing for generations. Produce eggs you can be proud of. All across the country, their small family farmers take pride in raising hens and providing certified organic free-range eggs that meet the highest standards. They do it because it's the right way to farm and because they want you to believe in what you buy. Learn more at PeteandJerrys.com. This episode contains explicit language.
I was in a bar in Nashville. And I was looking at their cocktail menu, and one of the drinks had the spirit listed, and it was pineapple rum. And so I asked, can you tell me which brand this rum is? And I pointed to the item on the menu. And she kind of looked away from me and then looked back and was very quiet and was like, it's Plantation pineapple rum. So what was that? It's Plantation. Okay. She's like, And then she just walked away.
This is Osai Endelin. She's a food writer and friend of the show. We met up in a bar in Crown Heights, Brooklyn a while back, so she could tell me this story.
Usually if you inquire about a spirit, a bartender, you know, in a place like that is going to break it down for you a little bit.
They're like excited to talk about it.
Yeah, they're going to give you maybe some notes on how it's made, or if they don't have that information, they might tell you at least what it tastes like. And she wasn't busy. Like, I was maybe one or two people at the bar. It was late in the evening. My read at the moment was that telling me, speaking to a black customer, like, I have to tell you that this brand of this rum that you're asking about is called Plantation. It just created a sense of awkwardness for her as a young white woman.
That brand name, Plantation, also bothered Osai.
I don't know that I want to celebrate and partake in a spirit that seems to be, in some way that I'm not clear about, calling forth a history where people who looked like me and people who made this rum were enslaved and subjected to mental and emotional and physical and sexual abuse over generations and generations. That, for me, is the immediate connection. And I just couldn't fathom, like, why anybody would want their rum to be associated with that.
So Osai is sitting at this bar in Nashville by herself, and the idea of this plantation rum is stirring up all these feelings for her. She's becoming more and more curious, not only about how it got its name, but about how it tastes. So she decides to try it. She orders the pineapple rum drink, the bartender mixes it all up, and brings it over.
I thought it was awesome. I was like, oh no. This is really good. Fuck. You know? Yeah.
This is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people. In the food world, the word plantation pops up a lot. Recipes, restaurant names, cookbooks. It's the name of a line of teas that might be in your cupboard right now, Bigelow Plantation Mint. TV chef Andrew Zimmern has a plantation rice recipe. Rachel Ray has a plantation dinner recipe. To be totally honest, most of my life, I never gave it much thought. Until folks like Osai and others started talking to me about it. So this episode's about the word plantation in food and how white people in America use it. Now, back to me and Osai in Crown Heights over a couple of glasses of plantation rum.
All right, so I have my plantation rum daiquiri here. What are you drinking, Osai?
This is a painkiller, and it has rum and coconut cream, and I think there's some aloe in here. It's basically like a pina colada.
With some hand lotion mixed in.
Yeah.
You know. Cheers.
Cheers.
Oh man, this daiquiri is firing on all cylinders, let me tell you.
It's happening.
Okay, back to the story. After Osai discovers plantation rum in that bar in Nashville, she decides to write a piece about it. After all, she's a food writer. So first off, she wants to know how it got its name. She emails the company that makes it. It's a cognac house in France called Maison Ferrand. And the owner, Alexander Gabriel, who's white, agrees to talk with her.
He explained to me that for him, plantation, as a Frenchman, is plantation, which la plantation translates to basically it's a farm. And so, you know, you take people at their word. I don't know that that absolves anything, but it was helpful to have I appreciated having the conversation.
So in a larger sense, when you see the word plantation, not just on this rum, but on a chicken dish in a restaurant, right, or anywhere, a plantation rice, whatever it is, assuming that it was the person who put it on that menu is not black.
Right.
What do you think that the person who did that was trying to convey? Because it's, as we know, it's not a culinary term. So you're not saying anything about the way that chicken or rice was cooked or the seasoning, you know, or anything. So what do you think is the, what do you think they think they're doing when they put that word there?
The most generous idea that I have around that is something pastoral, this sense of sort of, you know, an open agrarian idea. But that I'm really reaching. I mean, like, I'm really reaching. I don't know. I really don't understand what people are going for, particularly because it's not so common that it's everywhere, but it's consistent enough that someone obviously is tapping into something that they feel is useful to their audience. And that's the thing that I think people don't really want to be responsible for when they get questioned about this, because they don't want to identify what that thing is.
Osai's piece about plantation rum was published by the Southern Foodways Alliance, and it got some attention. A white writer named Eric Ginsburg wrote a piece for Vice saying people should stop using the word plantation to sell food. He interviewed Osai along with a lot of other top black scholars and writers in the food world. Michael Twitty, Nicole Taylor, Adrian Miller, and more. Osai was glad the conversation was happening. But one thing about that Vice piece frustrated her.
White people need to be talking to more white people about things like this, because it's not black people building the resorts named after a plantation and putting a fence in front of it.
So, Osai, I'm going to sort of try to set out to find some white people to talk to. To be as blunt as possible,
You're going on an expedition.
I'm going on an expedition, yes. What are you curious about?
Well, I would be curious. I am not as interested in the conversation of stop using the word as I am interested in the investigation of why the word keeps appearing. That is a real, it is a touchy subject, but I would love to hear that conversation from a place of real inquiry and not just like, let me get through this because it's an awkward thing, but I'll just go back to business as usual. I think it's going to be challenging for you to find somebody who wants to have a conversation with you that's like real. We'll see. I would love to be wrong. That would be a vote of confidence.
Well, I'm not making any promises, Osai. <Yeah. laughs> All right, well, cheers.
Cheers.
Good drinking with you.
This is great. I totally lapped you on this cocktail.
You did.
Well,
I'll catch up.
For you.
Yeah.
From there, we here at Team Sporkful started tracking down examples of plantation branding in food. We found restaurants all over the country using the word in their name. From San Diego to upstate New York, from Wisconsin to the Jersey Shore to North Carolina. Places like Southern Plantation Restaurant and Plantation Supper Club. And there were examples on food blogs, menus, and in cookbooks. Dishes like Plantation Crunch and Old Virginia Plantation Spoon Bread. As I said, there are big chefs and brands using it too. We reached out multiple times to Bigelow Tea, who make that plantation mint flavor, but they declined to comment. TV chefs Andrew Zimmern and Rachel Ray also turned us down. One food blogger told us she listens to The Sporkful and would be honored to be on the show, but she didn't want to talk about a topic that might, quote, flame the fires that still burn in this country. She added, I myself have friends who are still tender on the subject. I best tread lightly. Overall, 22 people and companies declined to talk with us. But that wasn't everyone. We got 8 people who are using or have used the word plantation and food, all of them white, to talk with us. Restaurateurs, cookbook authors, bloggers. I wanted to ask them Osaya's question. What are you trying to communicate with the word plantation? The day of the first conversation, I went into the studio a little early before making any calls. My producers asked me to try to describe how I was feeling about our mission.
You know, like in sci-fi movies, or whether it's like even like Spaceballs or Star Wars, like when they're in the giant battleship and the alarm goes off and this automated system always exists on the spaceship to have all these walls go up to block all the hallways. It's like, that's what talking about race used to feel like for me. Like, just like immediately, like, oh, this is uncomfortable. Oh, I'm going to screw this up. And I really, really think I'm probably using the wrong words for this. So I really think we should just change the subject because I'm pretty sure I'm going to offend someone and then they're going to think that I'm racist. I mean, I grew up in a white town. My high school graduating class was 145 people. I don't think there was a single black person in our graduating class. There were a handful of other people of color. I was one of the very few Jewish kids. I mean, it was overwhelmingly white Christian town. So I was very uncomfortable talking about race. And in the early episodes of The Sporkful, when I attempted to talk about it, I would be like a stuttering, blubbering mess. You know, I think that sometimes on this show, when we spend more time digging into something in great detail, I like it when it changes the way that people look at that thing forever and changes the way I look at that thing forever. I mean, I think that the hope is that this will reveal something about whiteness.
Hello.
Hi, Blair.
Yes.
Hey, it's Dan Pashman from The Sporkful. How are you?
Hi, Dan. I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks so much for making time for us today.
Yeah, good to talk to you.
This is Blair Lonergan. She runs a food blog called The Seasoned Mom. She has a recipe there for Old Virginia Plantation Spoon Bread. Blair is from Virginia, but the name is more connected to her grandmother, who grew up in Chicago with Polish immigrant parents.
So my grandmother, at the holidays, she loved to go to Colonial Williamsburg to have a meal at one of the historic taverns, and then just to kind of walk around and see the holiday decorations and do some shopping.
What do you think your grandmother especially loved about Colonial Williamsburg?
She had this kind of fascination with Southern culture and historical colonial Virginia, just maybe some nostalgia or American culture that she was fascinated by because it was so different from the way she was raised and where she grew up.
And tell me about the name of the dish, because you said you created this, so you gave it its name mm-hmm. on your website,
right.
Old Virginia
right.
Plantation Spoon Bread. Where'd you come up with the name?
I want people to see a recipe on my site and instantly have a strong reaction. If I had just named this post Spoon Bread, to me, it doesn't have nearly the appeal as if I attach Old Virginia Plantation Spoon Bread to the post, because that automatically conjures an image in the reader's mind as to what I would think might be a comforting, cozy dish that goes back generations, that might remind someone of the meals that they ate at their grandmother's table. So it was really just my attempt at making something as simple and basic as spoon bread sound more appealing to the potential reader.
I asked similar questions to everyone I spoke with. I'll tell you who they all are, but first, I just want you to get a feel for the conversations.
plentiful food, lots of food is what I envision when I hear plantation.
And where do you think that image, that idea of plentiful food at a plantation comes from?
I don't know.
I think it just comes from our culture, from, you know, such a young age of, you know, pictures we see in storybooks.
Just media over the years and reading books and imagining it in your head.
The cozy scenes that you see in cookbooks.
Yeah, I think of Gone with the Wind, plantations and stuff like that. That's my impression. Scarlet and all that kind of stuff.
Those clips began and ended with Tom Gumhold. He owned the Plantation Supper Club in Wisconsin until it closed recently. In there, you also heard Mary Ann Dwyer, who runs the Beach House Kitchen blog. She has a recipe there for plantation crunch. And you heard Blair Lonergan again. Tom Gumhold mentioned Gone with the Wind and Scarlett O'Hara. He wasn't the only one to connect his image of plantations to that film.
They just saw this big pillared white mansion, horse and buggies and people all dressed up. You know, probably Gone with the Wind, you know, from that perspective.
This is Vinnie Carbone, chef and owner of Carbone's Ristorante in Hartford, Connecticut. His grandfather and uncle opened the place in 1938 and called it Southern Plantation Restaurant. They avoided an Italian name because they were worried about anti-Italian prejudice. They changed the name to Carbone's in 1961, when Italian restaurants were becoming more mainstream.
And am I right, at the time that your grandfather and his brother named their restaurant Southern Plantation, had they even ever been to the South?
No.
So where exactly did that image come from?
So here's really the first question, Professor. Up until a year or two ago, if I heard the word plantation in food, someone offered me a dish of plantation chicken or a nice glass of plantation mint tea, that word plantation would immediately conjure for me an image of this old South home with the big white pillars, the columns in front, and the big wraparound porch. Maybe there's a pitcher of sweet tea on the veranda and, you know, granddaddy in a rocking chair, and then there's kids frolicking in the front yard, and eventually there's a big picnic table with a red and white tablecloth, and all this, a huge bountiful array of food arrives, fried chicken and collard greens, and it's very beautiful, it's idyllic, it's leisurely, and it's delicious, and it's very comforting. That's a warm and fuzzy image for me. I have never seen that with my own eyes. I've never experienced that in my life. I'm a 42-year-old white guy from New Jersey. So my first question to you is, how did that image get in my head?
Well, that's interesting because I was listening to your description of that and I didn't hear you once say, and you were being served by an African-American.
This is Professor Karen Cox.
That image has been around for a long time, and it has so much to do with popular culture.
Coming up, we take a deeper look at what that plantation image is really communicating. And we ask how so many of these folks I'm talking with, and I, got that blissful picture in our heads. Plus, the conversations continue, and things get more tense.
You know, I really don't enjoy this conversation. There are two very different, very contrasting ways of looking at a simple word.
I don't want my kids to feel guilty because they're white.
Whether you're a family vacation traveler, a business tripper, or a long weekend adventurer, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. They've got over 7,000 locations and 22 brands, including Comfort Hotels, Radisson Hotels, and Cambria Hotels. And you will get the best value for your money when you book with Choice Hotels. I especially love those Cambria Hotels. They have locally inspired hotel bars with all kinds of specialty cocktails, downtown locations right in the center of all the action. Radisson Hotels have flexible workspaces. That way, if you're a business traveler, you'll be able to get all your work done. On-site restaurants, fantastic. And then at Comfort Hotels, you'll enjoy free hot breakfast with fresh waffles and great pools for the whole family and spacious rooms. I mean, if you have kids, you understand the importance of the pool. If you stay at a hotel with a pool, almost nothing else matters. Fortunately, all the Choice Hotels take care of all the other stuff too, but I mean, a pool is a great start. Whatever kind of vacation you're going on, whatever kind of travel you're doing, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. Recently, I went into my closet to try to get a collared shirt out, and it occurred to me that I don't think I have bought a new collared shirt in 5 years. I mean, every shirt in there was either really old, or it had some kind of perma-stain situation, or it probably never fit right in the first place. I gotta freshen up a little bit here. It's time for something new, right? And spring is coming. Now is the time if you've been looking to refresh your wardrobe, home, or skincare and beauty routines this season. Because, you know, Walmart has genuinely surprising style finds that don't break the bank. This spring, there's only one destination for the latest fashion, home, and beauty inspired by real life. Walmart. I freshened up my wardrobe. I got some nice dress shirts, a couple light hoodies. You know, you need light hoodies for the springtime. Very useful, very comfortable. Discover surprisingly stylish new season favorites at Walmart now, or shop it all on the Walmart app. Go to walmart.com/nowtrending. That's walmart.com/nowtrending. Now trending, your style at Walmart. A few years back, my friend Justin Warner from Food Network moved out to South Dakota. He opened a ramen joint, and he is always posting pictures of all the great food he's not only cooking, but eating all over South Dakota. He's always telling me to come visit. And you know, one of the best ways to experience a new place is to eat your way through it. But it's equally important to live your way through it, too. And when you summer in South Dakota, you can fill up on all the lake days, hikes, rides, and small-town strolls that'll leave you with a regained sense of wonder and a hunger to do it all over again. See why there's so much South Dakota, so little time at TravelSouthDakota.com. I enjoy a nice glass of wine, but I don't pretend to be an expert in wine. I usually just want a wine that's high quality, delicious, and not too expensive. And to me, that's Bogle Family Vineyards. And here's the thing about Bogle. This is a third generation family-owned winery from California that makes exceptional wines for about $10 a bottle. Bogle wines consistently earn best buy designations and high ratings from wine enthusiasts. And let me tell you something, the folks at Wine Enthusiast, they drink a lot of wine. They drink a lot of fancy, expensive wine, and yet they still keep giving great ratings to Bogle. And Bogle Vineyards has so many different kinds of wine. Whatever your mood, whatever you're eating, there's a wine for you. They got this great Pinot Grigio that's crisp and fruity, goes well with spicy foods, with fish. They have a classic Chardonnay that's balanced, amazing with a pork tenderloin or butter chicken. I like to take that Chardonnay and do what Jacques Pepin taught me, a couple of ice cubes in your glass of Bogle. If Jacques Pepin says it's okay, then it's okay. And there's the Bogle Pinot Noir, refined and elegant with bright fruit and about as food-friendly as a red wine can be. You're not going to believe it's only $10. Neither will your friends if you tell them. So pick up a few bottles of Bogle wherever you buy your favorite wines. Please drink responsibly.
I don't want any of that nonsense. I think that's nonsense.
Hope you're hungry because it's time for some ads.
Welcome back to The Sporkful. I'm Dan Pashman. If you're new to our show, I hope you'll take a minute and scroll through our feed, check out a few of our other episodes. We use food to get into science, history, culture, and absurd debates about the best way to layer a PB&J. Point is, we cover a lot of ground. I'm sure we have other episodes for you. And if you're enjoying this episode in Apple Podcasts, please take a minute right now to subscribe. That helps out our show, and it makes sure you don't miss future episodes. Go ahead, you can hit subscribe in Apple Podcasts. If you listen in Spotify, follow. If you listen in Stitcher, favorite. Thanks. Okay, back to the show. And let's pick up with my conversation with Professor Karen Cox, who you started to hear before the break. She's a history professor at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. She's white, and she's the author of Dreaming of Dixie, How the South Was Created in American Popular Culture. Even before the Civil War, Professor Cox says white writers published plenty of books that made life in the South look pretty great, even for enslaved people. Then, in the late 1800s, this messaging started to spread as advertising and mass marketing emerged. That's when Aunt Jemima was created. But it was in the 1920s and 30s that the branding of the South and plantation life really took off.
There were 75 films in the 1930s that were set on the plantation or in the plantation South. Even before Gone with the Wind was even an idea in Margaret Mitchell's head. You have an image of the South that is leisurely, that is wealthy, and in which Blacks play the role of servant, although they call them servants. They're not saying they're slaves, but that's exactly what they were. If you watch Gone with the Wind, that's what you see. You know, these are faithful people that don't leave their white families.
And Professor Cox says it wasn't just movies. Lots of food brands emerged around this time that portrayed Black Americans in the role of servants, from Longwood Plantation brand syrup to Uncle Ben's. So what's happening at this time that's making Americans gravitate to this image of life on the plantation? Two things. First, the Industrial Revolution.
Industry was just grinding people down, and they longed for a place that was American where things were easier.
The other factor, the Great Migration. Black Americans are moving north in large numbers for the first time in search of work and better lives. And Professor Cox says that's making white folks in the north very anxious. So marketers in New York create products and movies and books that remind white people in the North of a time when life was easy and affluent, when they were in their rightful place above black people. The basic message, you may not have a black servant, but if you buy this pancake mix, it's the next best thing.
What Aunt Jemima and all these other caricatures of the South were about was about Northern capitalism and wanting to just make a, they knew they could make a buck off of it.
Yes, the Northern capitalists saw that they could make a buck by latching on to this whitewashed image and selling it. But the other side of that coin is like, you know, some marketing pitches work better than others. Some marketing pitches last longer than others. This one was especially effective and has bored itself deep into the public consciousness. And so for that to happen, the people receiving the marketing have to really like it. You know, like, it has to really strike a chord. So it's not just a commentary on the people creating the advertising. It's also on the commentary on the people who are swayed by the advertising.
I agree with that. I think it is a combination of the two, you know, because, you know, you don't sell anything that people don't already have in their mind. It's also the reason that plantation tourism takes off in the 1930s, because people want to see it and feel it for themselves.
I see the plantation as a place of horror.
This is Professor Psyche Williams-Forson from the University of Maryland in College Park. She's Black, and her research in American studies focuses on cultural history, food, and race.
All I can think about and all I can see is at some point, on either side of me, women, men, children, as young as maybe 3 or 4, were out there possibly under the lash and under the threat of being beaten, killed, having your family members sold away.
Despite that association, Professor Williams-Forson can see why plantation branding has been so effective.
I mean, it's no secret that the South is a culinary bastion, right? This is where the tastes and the flavors come alive and you know, mix and mingle. So the notion of the plantation as a brand evokes, it must be sweet, it must be flavorful. This is for a segment of the population.
To be clear, the lines aren't completely black and white. Professor Williams-Forson says it's not like all Black Americans know this history. And as another historian we spoke with pointed out, there are Black Americans who don't care about plantation imagery. Some even enjoy it. But the history of that imagery is one of white marketers trying to appeal to white consumers.
It evokes a past that has long gone for a lot of people that many wish was still there. There are too many people coming into this country. We need to close the borders. We need to do this. We need to do that. That idyllic past gets put on these objects to soothe the nervousness and the discomfort and the frustration. Now, you may not, in your mind, you may not go back to slavery or anything like that. You may not drink plantation tea and think slavery or think, you know, but what it does is there's an unconscious comfort.
So, Professor, as I said, up until recently, the word plantation would have evoked that happy, idyllic image that I described for me.
Mm-hmm.
How is it possible that I was able to go 40-ish years living in America without having that image ever challenged or questioned?
Well, that's a very interesting question. Who's going to challenge it? What spaces were you in that question, that image would have been challenged? Did you grow up in African-American communities? Did you grow up in African-American communities of people who know these historical trends? Where would you have met that challenge? Would it have been in your primary or secondary school system where our textbooks tell us that, you know, slavery was really about workers? Your question is exactly why we have people going to plantations saying, I want to hear about the plantation and not about slavery, as if the two can be separated. Who's challenging them? No one.
That plantation branding that both professors talked about, you still see plenty of it today. Bigelow is one of the biggest tea companies in the country. You can find their tea at Walmart, Target, Amazon. Like I said, they sell a plantation mint tea. And they also have a black tea that they advertise as coming from their Charleston tea plantation. The back of the box reads, over 100 years ago, tea planters brought their finest ancestral tea bushes from China and India to Wadmalaw Island near the historic old city of Charleston, South Carolina. Now the direct descendants of these very plants have been lovingly restored to their former grandeur here at Charleston Tea Plantation, a lush subtropical tea farm. The label continues, it is in this context of great natural beauty and colonial pride that we bring you American classic tea. Please come see us for a unique, enjoyable tour of a working tea farm. And then Bigelow's website says the tour is, quote, a terrific way to experience historic Southern culture and a living piece of American history. Again, Bigelow declined multiple requests to comment for this episode. But as you heard, eight white folks using plantation branding in food did talk with us. Now, let's get back to those conversations.
Let's move a little bit beyond specifically the word plantation and think of it more as an issue of plantation imagery, an image of the old South that has been ingrained in all of us, including in me.
This is Britton Thrice. He publishes the Junior League of New Orleans Plantation Cookbook, which first came out in 1972.
I wonder if you worry at all that today, in 2019, that the book is in some way contributing to the furthering of this idyllic, very incomplete image.
Boy, who knows? I would want to hear from a contingent of Afro-Americans and to see what their feelings were.
I don't think that you meant it this way, but I'm curious just to sort of like unpack a little bit. In saying that that was your goal in using the word plantation, that readers would have such a sort of warm, fuzzy feeling, what you may inadvertently be saying is this recipe is and this blog are for white people.
No.
I know you don't intend it that way, but what I'm saying, look, I make this mistake too. Sometimes in our podcast, I'll say something a certain way and realize that like, oh, the way that I said that was like, as in my head, I was only talking to white people. So I think that it's an understandable thing to do, but like inadvertently, can you understand how it could come across that way?
I can now that we've had this conversation. And that is obviously, or I shouldn't say obviously, that is definitely not what I intended.
That was Blair Lonergan again. She was the very first caller we heard. Now, this next group includes Marianne Dwyer and Vinnie Carbone, both of whom you heard earlier. You'll also hear Ruthie Frierson, who helped write that plantation cookbook. And first, we'll hear Annie Butler, owner of the Butler Greenwood Plantation B&B. It's on land that's been in Annie's family since it was a working plantation, when her family owned enslaved people.
I don't like the implication that plantation means something negative. By the same token, I don't like the Scarlett O'Hara, you know, movie version of the romance of it either. I mean, it was a fact of life. It was a big farm.
I mean, I don't think anyone should forget, and I'm not trying to forget, and I don't think any of us should ever try to forget what happened and what it was like for people who worked on plantations. But, I think what I try to focus on, you know, when I cook, is I want to focus on the, you know, the hard work that the people did on those plantations and the food and the recipes that came out of it. And, you know, that's the, what I tend to focus on.
You know, we recognize and respect that, but it still was part of our history and can't be swept under the rug. Look at human history. People were in bondage longer and harder. And that's not saying what happened was right, but, you know, let's just move on. You know, my God, let's just move on.
History is history, and you don't erase it, and you don't take down all of the monuments to it. Political correctness is fine, but it's just gone to the opposite extreme, and somewhere in the middle there needs to be a balance of how much of our history we're willing to erase and rewrite, because I don't think that that is going to solve any problems.
What does it say about living in America that you and I can go through our lives without having to think about what the word plantation means to Black Americans?
Right. I don't know. I don't know what that says about our culture, that we don't want to acknowledge, or we don't want to focus on, or we don't want to admit this aspect of our country's history.
I don't think that's really fair, because I've thought about it since I was a little girl. I mean, a tiny little girl. And when I was in fifth grade and I rode a streetcar and they didn't allow Blacks to sit in the front, they had this, I'd sit in the back with the Blacks. I mean, I thought it was disgraceful. I mean, I've always had that in my heart and my feelings and in my faith.
How could I get managed to be 40-something years old in America, and it never would have occurred to me until a Black person pointed it out to me, that the word plantation has a negative connotation? I have the luxury of going 40-something years without ever having to even think about it.
Right. Right. No, I
and
get
that.
That is
a different experience.
But do you feel guilty about it?
Sometimes.
Because that's not right. I don't want to feel guilty. I want to know how you feel. I want to know what you've been through. So we don't repeat things of the future. And it's just healthy to have a perspective. And maybe there's smarter people than me that can make real curriculums to teach people the entirety of the times. But just to eradicate and erase things, that's stupidity.
So do you agree that you and I benefit from being white?
Right now, no. Right now, I think being Black is the way to go.
You know, I really don't enjoy this conversation much. I did not come into it thinking that this was going to be turning me into an apologist for slavery.
Hello.
Hey, Osai, how are you?
Oh, snap. It's been so long.
I know. So you're in Paris now?
I'm in Paris. I'm at this hotel. They have a rum bar here, of course.
Are they serving plantation rum there?
I haven't been to the rum bar yet. I just checked in, but they claim this particular bar has vintages of rum that aren't available anyplace else in the world. So I'm going to investigate this.
Okay. This is cool. This is a good beat that you stumbled into here, Osai.
I try to find it wherever
yeah.
I can.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So you heard that some of the discussions we had with the various folks that I spoke with.
Yeah, I did.
You heard the same thing our listeners heard. And so what are your thoughts?
I came away from listening to the clips like to varying degrees, different people were starting to interrogate themselves and the narratives that they haven't actually had to think very much about. And when that question is posited, when that seed is planted, it's very unsettling because it literally goes to the core of who you believe you are.
When we met up at the bar, you said, you know, you were really interested in trying to understand what are people who use the word plantation trying to communicate? What do they think they're communicating when they use the word?
Yeah.
And then you also said, but you're less interested in getting people to stop using the word.
Yeah.
So, and I think that to some, I can imagine that some white listeners, at least, I'm not going to speak for all listeners, would just be surprised. They would think that seems like the logical place to go.
I think it is a logical place to go, but I don't want to push you there out of shame. I want you to get there on your own 2 feet. And this is probably my biggest issue with all that we're talking about. So many white people feel like they need a black person to give them like the gift of deliverance into the American psyche so they can understand better who they are and where they come from. I have to read shit. I have to research. I have to think. I have to unpack. I have to talk to relatives. I have to read between the lines. I have to watch movies that make me really uncomfortable because I want to know the context in which they were created and disseminated and popularized. That's what doing the work means. Like, I did not come out of my mother's womb just with this, like a Pop-Tart with this information. I minored in Afro-American studies at UCLA. And when I say racism, when I say racist, I'm talking about systemic things. That's where people, I think, oftentimes really don't want to look because you have to be super accountable for the things that you're complicit in and the information that you have avoided receiving for a very long time.
And it's interesting because after going through this process of talking to all these people, it's like I found myself with each conversation dreading the conversations more and more. It was demoralizing. It was frustrating. And so that certainly gave me a different perspective on being in the position to constantly have to explain.
I appreciate you sharing that with me. I mean, and it's not surprising to me at all, but you get to sort of like turn the mic off, hang up the phone, and then go back to a life where none of that really is going to affect you or your family in a negative way. But for African-American people, for Black people, that never goes away, and it is life-threatening on every level.
So, Osai, you talked about sort of this idea that white people want a Black person to kind of hold their hand and, you know, bring them to deliverance. I'll be honest, like, we weren't sure whether I should call you back at the end of this, because we didn't want you to be in that exact position, you know? So how do we put together this episode? How do we end this episode so that you aren't in that position?
Oh, well, I think it's too late for that. I mean, I wrote the piece that got us here.
One of the questions I was left with after all this was, if we were to really try to tell a more complete history of plantations, what would that look like? And how would most white Americans react? So next week, in part two of this series, I'm going to a plantation to find out. And not just any plantation, Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. The kitchen at Monticello was probably the most influential in American history. I'll tour the kitchen with a descendant of the enslaved chefs who cooked there, as well as culinary historian Michael Twitty. That's next week. If you connected with this episode and think other people might appreciate it, I hope you'll share it on social media and tag The Sporkful.
And please subscribe to our show in Apple Podcasts. If you listen in Spotify, follow. If you listen in Stitcher, favorite. Thank you. My thanks to food writer Osai Endelin. Her essay that inspired this episode is called Distilled Identity. It was published by the Southern Foodways Alliance. She also has an essay in Charlotte Druckman's forthcoming anthology, Women on Food. And she's lately been a guest editor on Eater.com's Young Guns section, which features newer industry talent. We'll link to all of Osai's work at Sporkful.com. Thanks also to Shannon Mustafer and everyone at Gladys in Brooklyn, where Osai and I had our cocktails. That reminded me just how good a classic daiquiri can be. Rum, sugar, lime juice, that is all you need. And the one at Gladys was on point. This show is produced by me, along with senior producer
Anne Sani,
and associate producer
Ngofen Mputubwele.
Our editor is Peter Clowney. Additional editing and production on this episode by Osai Endelin, Claire Rawlinson, Oluwakemi Aladasui, Nick Jones, Harry Huggins, and Brian Moore. Our engineer is
Jared O'Connell.
Music help from Black Label Music. The Sporkful is a production of Stitcher. Our executive producers are Chris Bannon and Daisy Rosario. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
And I'm Ari Strauss from Washington, D.C., reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.